No, I think, I think business is fun. I mean, I think it's like a game. And people say to me, hey, when are you going to retire? I say, well, when I don't enjoy the game anymore.
The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.
Tony, great to have you on the podcast. How are you?
Great to be here. Thanks.
Excellent. Well, look, you've had an incredible career so far, and you know, I think a lot of people are very curious around your business journey and your successes. And no doubt there's been some challenges and interesting bits and pieces of learning. But before we get into all of that, it'd be great to go back to the beginning and know a little bit about where you grew up and you know what were your interests as a youngster.
Well, I'm an Auckland boy, born and bred. And I was inherently very, very shy. So shy that the headmaster mentioned something that somebody did, I immediately blushed. I just go around thinking everyone was looking at me. And quite naive too. And so I sort of went through school. I wasn't really I wasn't a good student. I wasn't a bad student either. I didn't really study very much and missed school certificate, went on and did my apprenticeship as a baker pastry cook. And it was while I was there, or when I was virtually at the end of my apprenticeship, a friend of mine told me about these things called girls. And he said, you want to come to university? There are these girls around. And when you're a baker pastry cook, you're working at night, you have no social life at all, sleep during the day. So I thought, I finished off my last 500 hours and part-time and went to university part-time. My parents were German, and so I could speak German. Well, I had a fair knowledge of German, so I thought, well, I'll be able to pass German 1. That would be pretty good. Parents would be pretty happy about that. Son was at university and passing a subject. So anyway, when I got there, the same friend who told me about girls said, what do you do an arts degree? Do accounting. Everybody passes that. So I found I could do German 1 and accounting. Of course, I failed accounting 1, but but anyway, over 5 years, I finished off my degree, went straight overseas, joined a ice skating show, which was part of Madison Square Gardens Corporation, and went down to South America, traveled around South America with a team of ice skaters, mainly East Block kids, and after a year, Madison Square Gardens took over a company in Vienna called the Vienna Ice Review. And they asked, well, who speaks German? So I put my hand up. Fantastic. And I was off to Vienna. Great. So came back, lived in Vienna for about 3 months before I took that group around Europe and then down to South America again. So when I came back to New Zealand with all that financial experience, which I had none, I mean, it was all just dealing with promoters, all virtually a cash business, I got a job as finance manager of Polaroid, which was just starting up in New Zealand. And so I was trained by the finance manager in Australia, a bit older than me. And after a month, I was reading my Accounting 1 textbooks, and I rang up. I said, Merv, listen, I'm a fraud. I can't do this. I've got no idea, absolutely no idea. And he said, listen, don't worry, Tony. I'll come over every month and do your monthly accounts. You like that whole marketing area? Get into that.
Wow.
You know, we won't tell anyone. You'll still be finance manager. So I used to go to these meetings as finance manager in Honolulu, and they were talking about FASB 8 and all these bloody accounting things. I had no idea what they were talking about, but it was bloody great being in Honolulu. And so I got into marketing, and then it was at the age of 24, you'd probably call it an epiphany, but I suddenly realized I thought differently from other people. And I kept on coming up with ideas, and people would say, well, gee, why didn't we think of that? And so then I came up with an idea. The trustee savings banks wanted a Visa card with a photo on it. And we could do that. And it was a time of Muldoon, and there was 60% sales tax on cameras. And we had the cameras that could make these ID cards and could do the program. But when we worked out what they'd need, the budget wasn't there. I mean, we were just miles out. So I went back to our head office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and said, hey, listen, why don't we rent these things in $100 a month? And I've My whole life I've always worked at tens or hundreds, $100 a month, and we're going to get our payback in film burn. They'll waste film. It will be a successful program. So we get our money back. And so that's what happened. We got the deal. But then they said, gee, why don't we do this globally? And so from then on, they were selling three or four times as many of these ID machines around the world. So I became a bit of a hero in the company, and got offered jobs in the US and Europe, a marketing manager of Canada. And I had aging parents, so I decided I wasn't going to move. So they appointed my general manager to a position in Canada, and I became general manager at the age of 29. So,
fantastic.
And I was still pretty shy. And in fact,
Confidence must have grown though with those successes along the way, and you know, going through your 20s, so there was a.
Well, what the confidence did grow, and I went to Norman Godden, who was the person who got me an earlier job, and I said, "Listen, I don't know if I'm ready for this general manager's job." And he said, "Listen, you're going to have to learn to speak and etc. So go to Toastmasters, which, by the way, is where I met my wife at Toastmasters, and I decided I quite liked being the boss. And from then on, I said, I'm going to stay the boss. And I really love my time at Polar. It's just great working for US multinational. If things are going right, they look after you. And obviously having Honolulu halfway between here and Cambridge, Massachusetts, it was a good spot to have conferences all the time. So I loved it. And then I joined a public company called Optical Holdings. And the share price was 38 cents. And again, as chief executive, share price of 38 cents. When I left 3 years later, it was over $12. And so it was the highest growth stock on the stock exchange. Again, got a lot of, for 2 years running, and a lot of publicity. I started believing in my own PR, which is fatal.
So what happened? How did that level of, result sort of happen on the stock exchange? What was...
Well, just the company was really insolvent when I came in there, and I remember going to the bank and saying it was only $2 million, which seems nothing today, but they were going to put us under. They appoint a manager before they appoint a receiver to see if they can do anything. And I went in there. I'd certainly decimated the senior staff and said, listen, I need another $2 million. I'd got the so we're going to launch a product called Lispex. Showed them the ads, and that was good. We had a whole lot of asset. We manufactured frames, sunglass and optical frames. We had a lot of acetate there. I knew that in the UK, everybody wore virtually the same glasses because National Health provided them. They were all black. They'd be very fashionable now, but they're black horn rim glasses. We had all acetate in very, very bright colours. So I got a designer out of Australia, Jonathan Skeets, and he designed 8 frames, which were very out there, and we launched them in the UK. Again, I took a £10,000 ad in Vogue magazine, a full page, when we really had no money as a company, and my sister-in-law lived in London, and I would send her out every day with the Vogue magazine. Have you got these glasses? And I haven't seen these. And then I'd go in, or a sales rep would go in a week later, and everyone'd be looking for them. We sold them in packs of 12. We manufactured them for under $10, and we're selling for £69. A very, very profitable sort of business. And so that's what turned the company around, and then we launched Latan, launched other optical frames, we launched a pillowtree cream. And every time, pharmacies just loved it. Loved me because they knew every time I bought out a product, we were going to advertise on TV, it would be a success. So then I thought, well, I'll get out of this, time to do my own thing. And I tried to get the agency for Swatch Watch, which was being launched in Europe and America, being big success. So I rang them up, and the agency had gone to somewhere else. So I rang up somewhere else, rang up the receptionist, and I said, I hear you're launching Swatch in New Zealand, I want to get one. Said, oh, and they were only launching it on in September. I said, when in September? Tell me the date. Said, how much? How many designs? How many colours? What's the deal? And so I knew their whole marketing plan. Went off to Hong Kong, got the same product, or got similar product, more designs, more colours. And we launched, we knew they were going out at $69. We launched a product, we called it Z-Watch, which was on a, with a little hang tag, which was like a Swiss flag, but instead of the plus of the Switzerland, it was a Z, and then we called it Z-Watch. And then we had the same type of TV ad. We knew we both launched on the same day. They had no idea we were coming. And between September and December, we sold 27,000 watches. They sold 6,000. It was a marketing success story. But the plasticizer and the strap got brittle over time. Most of the strap, most of the watches got sold for Christmas, to kids for Christmas. When you put the watch on, it immediately snapped.
Oh, dear.
So suddenly they all came back. And I had a little box in, post office box in Remuera, and opened that up every day. There was just a little card out the back, and there were 2, 3, 4 mailbags of watches. Obviously, my guy in Hong Kong had gone. Again, I took some advice. I'd made some money out of optical holdings. I lost a lot, and I could have put the company into receivership, but the advice was, listen, New Zealand's too small, just pay them back, get, you know, do what you can. Unfortunately, this guarantee went on for 2 years, and so for 2 years we were just often giving money back, replacing watches, a lot of stress, no money coming in. So that was a real bad time in my life. And then
how did you cope with that? You know, what does that do to you? Because,
well, I am a very, very positive person. It's probably the only time in my life that I sort of felt, geez, you're blowing it. Particularly because I'd come from a real high from just being thinking I was a superhero. I could do anything. I could walk on water.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I'd crash down. And I know for sort of a year afterwards, I know I wasn't making the best decisions, doing things, and I thought, you know. But anyway, once I popped out of it, and then I was very fortunate that the company is a public company, Unity Group, and one of their guys had been the audit manager at Optical Holdings. And he rang me up one day and he said, listen, I'm working. He had no idea about Z-Watch. He rang me up one day and he said, Tony, listen, I saw what you did at Optical Holdings. We've just taken over a company from Christchurch, got a $60 million turnover, losing $3 million. You're the man to do it. What are you doing now? I said, oh, you know, mumbled away.
Yeah.
And he said, listen, and we'll give you $100,000 to as a sign on. And that's what I needed to not sell my house.
Yeah.
So I grabbed at that and worked for them for quite a few months. This is going back to 1987. And we're really, most of the businesses were agency business. There were no brands and we sold them off. And then just prior to the share market crash, I said, listen, I'm really redundant, but I got a couple of ideas. One of them was renting fax machines. I said, listen, everyone else is selling them because they only want, the sales reps only want to go in once and it's a hot market. They don't want to go back, get credit approval and then go and install the machine. We'd follow the Xerox, what Xerox did originally with photocopiers. We'd put the machine in, they took it, and if it fell over, you just take it out, put it somewhere else. It doesn't have to be a new machine on rental. And so they said, yeah, go ahead. Anyway, then we had the share market crash, January 88. The managing director said to me, listen, do you want to buy that company for a dollar? And we signed a sale and purchase agreement for a dollar, and I bought what was Red Eagle and then evolved into Just Water. The reason I got into water coolers was I needed another office product. I had faxes, they were going well. They went really well through 88 because branch managers could approve a rental. You know, a sale, a capital cost had to go up higher, just like the GFC. And so I'd seen a water cooler on a US sitcom, and New Zealanders were starting to get into jogging and talking a lot more about health. Well, you know, I reckon there's a chance here of selling water, would you? Who's going to buy water? And so we bought
a ballsy move at that time, right? I mean, I don't think there probably wasn't a lot of bottled water that was sold in any form. Water coolers just wouldn't have been the norm at all.
No, and so, I saw it as an office product. Didn't see it as a water thing. I put these things. So I bought six. and ran an ad in the Herald, which was showed all these googlies in the water and saying your water's not safe, which was a horrible ad. And but they went, six went, and then we were into container loads within a few months. But and I didn't realise this is not an office, but you have to service these things. So we're getting all these, started getting all these green bottles coming back. And so the message I told the customer service, you just say, oh, wow, haven't heard that before. Just send it back, we'll get you another one. And anyway, within a few months, we had a service team on.
Yeah, I recognized you want to sort that out pretty quickly.
Yeah, we realized that you have to service these things. It grew very fast. We and the problem with, and I remember it's a quote from Drucker that if your business grows, if you're a startup business and you grow fast, you will run into cash problems. And I didn't think we'd run into cash problems, but I thought that's what the bank was for. And that they would see this business that, hey, every time we signed a rental agreement, they could see all this rental coming in on automatic payment. So we had one very, very successful year and the bank called me in on a Friday afternoon. I thought, I went in very smart, put on my smartest clothes. I thought they're going to have scones and cakes for me and say, hey, congratulations on a great year. And they came in and said, we want our money back. And I said, what? Why would you want your money back? I just couldn't believe it. I didn't get stressed by it. I know I wrote to the managing director of the particular bank and said, listen, my father banked here. We've never had a bad debt, never check that's gone wrong. And anyway, could get no. And meanwhile, we'd bought our own building off Westpac, which I hadn't told our bank. on the Never Never.
Oh dear.
Because there'd been a bit of a property crash. And so we were opening that the next week. And the Prime Minister was going to come there to open it. And so, 3 weeks, we got the Prime Minister, Bolger, saying, due to my government, small companies have prospered and look what the success of this company. And I'm looking over the lawyer, you've got 3 weeks left. Anyway, fortunately, we went with the BNZ and they've been a banker ever since. They thought they won an account because in those days, they could understand cash flow funding, which...
And they still do. Not all of the banks understand cash flow funding, do they? And I think that's... I went through on a different sort of scale, but business partner retiring and I wanted to buy out his share of the business. We went to our bank. And they just didn't seem to be on the same page. BNZ and ANZ seemed to be pretty geared up on that front. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, so the old way was you look at the balance sheet and if there's a whole lot of reds there out of it.
Yeah.
So we were in the BNZ, have been our banker ever since. And they really understand it because we took over a company in Australia and it went bad. And we went up to $27 million worth of debt. That quickly, but they knew that we had that cash flow that would repay that down relatively quickly, and that's what happened in these. And I know I said afterwards because I was pretty nervous. I said, "Did you ever put us in bad? Ever consider putting us in bad bank?" I said, "No, we could see that you guys, as long as you followed all the criteria we asked you for, it wasn't going to go bad." So we got through that. I probably had a few other disasters, and one of them was. We saw when we went into offices that people don't clean their coffee cups, right? And they'd be sitting on the desk and be signs up, mother doesn't work here. And it was very, very messy. And so we thought it was pretty good research. It was, we had a service team right around the country, seemed to be a nationwide problem. And so we got a product called Fresh Cup. And this was a unit, instead of putting it on the bench, just put it on this unit, pressed a button, it went round. Had a sanitizer and a detergent cartridge in it, and it cleaned and sanitized it. And then the next person came around. So it only took 30 seconds for two cups, put it on top, and it had a heater on top, and it would self-dry. Because it's around the edge of the cup was where the germs are, and people were putting them on towels or on the bench, just leaving them upside down. But it wasn't something people could see. And we used to go to trade shows and say, put your card in here, you do, and you could win a fresh cup. Monday morning, that was the lead source for all the reps. Yeah, hey, you've just won a fresh cup. And we couldn't sell these things. Because the big thing about this was, which I'm surprised Fisher and Paykel and all these companies haven't done this, it had its own cartridge with detergent and soap. So you could give these things away as long as they used this cartridge.
Right, like an inkjet printer sort of thing.
Yeah. And so we'd go, we'd go back, hey, you've just won this fresh cup.
Yep.
And no thanks. So not to have it. And everyone who got one loved it. So, it was just fantastic. But over a year, we sort of geared up to sell 2,000 and we sold 300. And that model didn't work. We had a full team, sales team, et cetera. Yeah, we made the decision to get out of it. We'd lost 800,000. We could have, could have carried on, but decided, so people are saying, never give up, never give up, never give up. There's a point where sometimes you just have to say, hey, I can use my resources a hell of a lot better doing something else. And we knew at the time the water coolers were going fine. Hey, that was something that we tried and didn't work.
Were there overseas trends that you looked at as well to get a handle on, does the product succeed elsewhere? Sounds like it was a reasonably unique product in the market. I don't, remember ever coming across anything like that. The water coolers, obviously that was something that was popular in other parts of the world. How do you look at those sort of global trends and translate them back to New Zealand?
Well, I think there are always, trade conferences. So the water cooler industry was relatively small. In fact, you knew all the players globally in it. And so it was doing that. I think in terms of selling product, at trade shows, it's all by chance. You meet people and something happens.
And so, what was next from there? What were the steps that got you to the point of listing on the stock exchange on the NZX?
So obviously when I'd been, even going back further from Polaroid, I'd learnt that how important PR was, how important looking bigger than you are was. And so when I was in this public company, Optical Holdings, I could see, and it's probably still the same today, directors almost don't like having annual meetings. And to me, I thought that's a time when you can really boast your company. And so we used to get big turnout by, we'd have dancing girls with glasses or models doing something to show our product and to make it exciting. People, our shareholders will be our best advocates. And so when I launched Just Water, I said, hey, in 5 years, we'll go public again. In fact, it took 15 years because you do have to have the problem with a rental business when you're successful is you're losing a lot of money because you're investing it all in new water coolers and you're only getting rental over a longer period of time. So it took us 15 years before we could actually show, hey, listen, we're showing a profit as well. So we only raised $8 million at the time. It wasn't because we needed the money, but it was more just the PR thing that big companies like, they feel more comfortable dealing with a company they think is bigger. It gives us a much higher profile. We're bigger now than we were, but when we were where we were, it was people perceived us much bigger than what we were. So that was important to us.
And what did that experience of listing, what did that look like? What were the steps that you went through? How long was the journey to list?
Yeah, probably... in our case, probably about a year. We hired ex-Deputy Prime Minister Jim McLay as chairman. So getting a board. We'd always had a board, one of which was my wife. That's probably the hardest thing you ever have to do when you have to fire your wife off the board. But we needed a people with experience hiring a board and then just going through the process. And I remember, Jim McLay saying, you have to be able to stand up in court. Everything you make, you have to guarantee that that's right. And, so all your statements just had to be absolutely right. So we went through the full story, went out there. It was seen as a great float to be in. And the ship, and not overselling, I think that not trying to, I wasn't taking any money out of it. We thought we had a pretty fair price that the shareholders who came in were going to make some profit on it, and that's what happened. So we went on. We obviously I said we bought in Australia and made a mess of that. Came back with our heads, what I call the lost decade, because we really couldn't do anything. We really felt, weren't forced, but I think the bank wouldn't have liked any acquisitions or anything. So we carried on.
Australia's often been a difficult market for New Zealand businesses to get into, hasn't it? So
what
did it look like for you?
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases it was the market. In our case, it was a circumstance in that the sales manager went off with a sales team. A lot of the records weren't there, and we couldn't take action against them, and so we lost 30% of the business straight away. And so you have an admin team, or a company structured that you can handle this much business. When it goes down by 30%, you're suddenly making big losses, and then there's just other personnel that left. And so,
what lessons did you take away from that? In hindsight, would you have done?
I know we've listened to that. We've looked at that quickly. One of the things was that we couldn't get accounts out. The CFO for over Christmas, about November, we couldn't get November accounts. It went December, so over Christmas you lose a couple of months. And by the time, we really lost sort of 5 months. And the big one was, hey, you can't get accounts out. We're bringing PwC in or somewhere, and we're going to get them out. As a public company, we're not going to go 1 month without knowing what's happening.
Yeah.
So we went for 5 months. That was the biggest learning. We bled a lot over that 5 months, and things that just went on. We were diverted. Our attention was diverted away by legal cases, which shouldn't have been. I mean, I went over in 1 week and the two legal cases sat down and they were gone. But you get diverted by that. And yeah, so some of the big things.
What did you learn about leadership during that time? Was that a period of picking up some new approaches, or has your approach sort of stayed, reasonably similar?
Well, prior to that, I'd always seen post-acquisition is probably more important than pre-acquisition, that you have to be in there and know everything right from day one, understand, meet the people, stay with the people, not be, I suppose other ones, I've gone, if the place is open at 7 o'clock, I'll be in there from 7 o'clock in the morning till the end of the day. Really just so that people come to you, people have got questions, you'll start picking out who the good people are, pick out the people that probably shouldn't be there and all that. And I left it for someone else to do and probably hadn't been trained in just post-acquisition and just doing that. And so came across probably fairly arrogant, and the team just didn't like him, and I should have paid more attention. The board should have paid more attention. Yeah.
Right, so that was probably what led to that exit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's a pretty painful lesson to...
That was a painful lesson.
To learn, isn't it? But yeah. It sort of is the nature of business, isn't it? And probably the nature of life in a lot of ways is we have to go through those tough times to get the learnings.
And also I was involved in a number of other businesses that were quite big, and one of them, the chief executive, left, and I was sort of trying to do two jobs and for quite a while. And one of them was Bartercard, which was a $200 million trading business. Another one, Euro, that really ran itself, but just being a director and being there. Yeah, and so I probably lost my focus. I say to anyone, hey, focus on what you're doing.
Yeah, that's a challenging one, because I'm picking you would have known at the time that you were going to be stretched doing both things, but you must have justified to yourself that was something that was doable for you.
Yeah, I think it's something that's just in your nature. Probably even now I do too many things. But, we have this expression, which is euphoria, skepticism, abandonment. So we go in lots of our process, whether it's an acquisition or we're doing new, hey, why don't we do this? The euphoria, hey, think about the next day, skepticism, and then often it's abandonment. More often than not, it's abandonment. But we always, hey, and our management team, hey, Tony, you're in the euphoria stage. Let's talk about this next week or tomorrow or whatever.
So you've you've ended up sort of building a bit of a process around that kind of entrepreneurial, creative, you know, spirit that you have that helps you to step back a little bit so you don't get, you know, too diverted with every idea.
Yeah.
It sounds like you must have a lot of ideas. I mean, your ideas are probably more successful than most of our ideas.
I try to get involved in them, and, you know, even at the moment we just had a strategy meeting and I'm trying to do a lot of things. We acquired a company called About Health, which has got Lester's Oil and ResV and a very, very successful online supplement company. And I just love this online business. You get your money up front, the stock, 6-month stock, can sit in a little office, and very easy to run and very, very successful. Now, how do we double that business? I soon was told, hey, Tony, you can't do that by yourself and trying to run the rest of the whole bloody thing. You're running yourself ragged. And I could see I wasn't doing it right. Say, hey, listen, we'll do this and we'll do this and do that part. And yeah, I need someone else there. Someone else. So anyway, we're going to hire someone else to help me on that one.
Sounds like a good move. And tell us about that acquisition. What was the journey there? And you know, how did you evaluate the that opportunity?
Well, we've done a number of acquisitions over the last 4 years, and that particular one was one I'd always been interested in the whole health area. I had run a supplement company many, many years before, and I just liked that business. And I'd gone to the owner about 5 years previously and said, hey, I want to buy your business. And we almost did a deal. Anyway, he wasn't really that interested in selling. And so last year I rang him up again. I said, hey, listen, remember we were touched base 5 years ago? And he said, yeah, no, I've sold 70% of the business, this company. And so we went to them. And they said, yeah, we can, let's talk. Because we're a public company, we have a better price earnings than private companies. So we can pay a higher price than other companies could. We were prepared to pay the higher price. They knew that was, you know, good margin, very simple business. We have criteria on how we buy things. And this just ticked every box. And so I said, listen, we have to be able to, we'll buy this on at a high price. And then since then, we've absorbed another company into it, same thing, and it's become very, very simple. But other acquisitions have been, gained the same criteria. We've been able to buy much cheaper and get immediate accretion in your own shares. So what I try to do, so we bought a company, the Cylinder Guy, and we bought it around about September of a year. And the owner will always say, hey, we're going to earn this much, but next year, look what we're going to earn. And so I said to him in this case, and what I really tried to do is say, listen, why don't we pay you 4 times earnings here? If you get to that, we'll be paying you 4 times. What I did say, if it was $2 million, you get to $3 million, you get the balance 4 times, $12, $12 million less the whatever we've paid you. Said, and you run it, all we'll do is come to board meetings or come to a meeting every month, but we won't alter anything. So he's really incentivized. For every dollar he can save, he's getting $4 at the other end. And if he can get more sales, which suits us too. So if he can get to $3 million, we'd be delighted. And that gives us a chance to really learn the business, really learn about the people. It's a very, very safe way, I find, of buying. And it gives him the incentive also. That's something that, you know, often try and do. In terms of, I think you can buy, if I'm buying a business, I love buying through a broker. And if I'm selling a business, I'd rather go to KPMG or PwC because they can really extract the most value and, you know, they'll go overseas, etc. So.
No, that's interesting. What you talked about there in terms of, keeping on, say, founder in a business and you're setting these particular incentives for that business to do very well. I guess that works in some businesses, but I do wonder around these sort of short-term incentives whether, you know, does that encourage some bad behaviour as well that, you know, might give good numbers, but actually you're doing some bad things in order to achieve those numbers that might impact the business longer term.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be careful of that. And we've done it. We started a business. You know, we said, hey, listen, we're going well in the business. The business starting to mature a bit. Let's go into the homes. So we got a sales team, and anybody, if they could breathe, they got a water cooler in their home. And we put out a lot of water coolers now with no credit check. And they just fell over. Was just very, very noisy in the office and credit control, customer services. You know, consumers tend to take more effort. And that's because we're incentivizing, hey, put out a water cooler and you get a commission. And put out a whole, put this number out, you get even more. And it's funny because it was so bad we saw it. Gee, we've just made a mistake and we stopped it totally. Whole team gone. And we thought we'll just let it go and having all these credit problems with it. But now we're down to a reasonable base, about 7,500 of these customers. They're good payers. There's 6.5% churn last year, which is, you know, we say that's damn good for any company. And so now we just have the strategy and we said, hey, we're going to have to double that. I mean, these guys are good. We know them. We know where they live. We know the type of customer. So we know the market now, absolutely. And we could make this work. We just made a mistake in the beginning. And you do. I mean, you know, starting a business, just being in business, you make a lot of mistakes. You just have to try and learn off them and not do them next time. I sometimes do them a second time, though.
Yeah. So any tips you can share about incentivizing in a manner that works well? How do you tend to do that, you know, these days?
In some companies, in a sales team, we'll do it on the margin. So it gives them some variability. They can vary the margin if they want to get the deal. So it's not just on a sale. A lot of sales has really changed. You know, we used to have 27 just water reps, had a lot of external reps, and we've now got none. So it's all internal. So it's an internal sales team, which is a much more efficient way of selling. So obviously we do, you know, a lot through digital to make sure that we get the phone ringing. We really don't even do that much outbound now. We've got a good brand to make sure that search engine optimization is good.
Right, so you're landing in the right place and when people are searching on Google.
Yeah, doing all that. Yeah, good knowledge of that. And we just make sure that we can get customers without having to have someone go out there. We can ask a lot of questions, and we've got two segments: healthy living, healthy homes. Healthy homes, we can sell over the phone just by asking the right questions. So I've got a ventilation system, for example, where the opposition need to go into your own home to be able to do a quote. We just ask for the measurements, say, hey, here's the price installed. And we can do that by asking the right questions. So we think that's inefficient to have the sales rep go out.
Right. So you might take a little bit of risk that some of them won't maybe pan out quite perfectly from not having been there. But if you're doing sufficient quantities and your calculations are pretty solid, then that plays out well.
Yeah. I think people don't. I mean, the companies do it, but it's having someone in your own home selling, you know, it's sort of, you sort of think the vacuum cleaner salesman, he's going to come in there and put the pressure on us. So do it on the phone or do it online, making it very, very easy for the customer to come on. I mean, I suppose if you look at it, Tesla has probably done the best job in terms of customer experience. We keep on saying, hey, we have to model ourselves on that. How do you make sure you make it a good customer experience from the time they come there? And if we can talk to them on the phone, we're building rapport immediately. So the more questions we ask, we find out about them.
So there's an aspect there where you're doing something different to what others in the market are doing. How do you come up with those different ideas for how not to be, you know, just a cookie cutter of what others are doing in the market? How do those things come together for you?
Yeah, I think, and probably an old-fashioned marketer, I mean, look at the, you know, what they call the four Ps: product, price, promotion, and place or distribution. And if you can get something different from the opposition, each one of those, you probably have the almighty success, but be a bit different in three of them. So, you know, so going back, talking about rental versus sale, talking about, I know the watches, even we distributed through pharmacies where the other guys did through through jewelers. So looking to be a bit different is something. You just take the attention of the consumer away from what they're thinking it should be.
Yeah, that's smart. That's good. And tell me a little bit about how you formulate your leadership team within a business, whether it's within, you know, Just Life Group or within other businesses you've been involved in. Any tips that you can share on that front?
So I'm an introvert. I surround myself by extroverts, and so I probably become more extroverted because I'm with them all the time. It's in terms of our leadership team, there are four of us. We meet every day at 4 on Zoom, and often it's generally it's only about 10 minutes. Often it'll go half an hour. It's very often about people. We're very concerned about culture and just maintaining it and making sure we get the very best to be the top leader and encourage. We say we want to take a good person and make them great. If we can't provide them the opportunity, we'll be proud they've been through they'll see Just Water as, or Just Life Group as part of their journey. So I think like attracts like. And so people like being there. Our values have the acronym FIRST, which is fun, integrity, respect, service, and trust. And by fun, we mean we provide nice facilities for them. We just do things. We don't encourage energy zappers. So we don't want people to, I don't have a desk. None of our management team have a desk. We just come in and we'll sit or normally stand somewhere, put our laptop down. And then upstairs we have offices, so if anyone needs an office, they can use it. And that works well, and you really start hearing what's happening. So we're saying, hey, you can talk to any of us. So there's no hierarchy, and so people feel comfortable with that. Induction is very, very important. We put a lot of effort into induction. People will be with us 20 years, and they'll always remember their first day. So we put a lot of effort into that. And one of the things we say is if you're not in business of fun and profit, what the hell are you doing there? We say that to the individual too, saying, hey, if you're not enjoying it here, then you're not profiting from it. You probably need to be somewhere else. So somebody maybe from civil service, for example, may not enjoy us in that we won't be, this is the only way to do it or whatever.
Yeah, that's good. So I'm interested in this first day. That's so memorable. So, tell us a little bit about that induction.
So the first day they have we have an induction app, and so they can go onto the app before they come, so they know a bit about the company. They get a form which shows where everybody is with their names on it, and then they go around the various departments. They go on the second day they go out on the truck delivering water. They go out servicing a water cooler with a service person. So they meet every team to find out what they do. I always meet them. We then have the senior leadership team takes them out for lunch. Go for lunch with them. Normally there's probably one or two people. I mean, their heads just, I'm sure they go home. Well, they do. They go home and they're absolutely blasted by it, but also positively blasted. So they go home, man, that was just great. Meet everybody, and then just make sure that we touch base all the time, particularly one that in their first day. So wife will say you do all your work at home, which is probably true, but a lot of that management walking around is pretty important.
Yeah,
and I think up to about 150, which is about what we've got. You do know everybody by name, and again, that's important. Like people, I took two out last week. They went, and they're both, last company, we'd never even met the chief executive. So suddenly I'd spend 20 minutes on them going through the history and the values and everything. And then they went out for lunch with us up to the local cafe. And we've had that right from day one that, hey, that's going to be a memorable day. That has to be a memorable day.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. And a lot of things have changed over the decades Can you speak to the role of diversity within the workplace? Is that something you could
have I know we got a diversity policy from one of our directors about 3 pages long. No, ours is one sentence, which is, you know, we don't discriminate on race, gender, et cetera, religion. And it's really, that's, we never have. And I know there's a lot of people regard diversity as gender diversity. And we have to look at, you know, like at the moment we said, hey, there are too many of us oldies here in management. And so, you know, we've taken on a couple of guys in our senior team who are in their 30s. We've had more, in terms of our leadership team of 12, we had 8 females, but it wasn't, they just happened to have 8 females. I think it's now moving to, you know, probably about 6 all. We've had a female group general manager. And, yeah, I think that's our board is probably, you know, we've taken on a what they call a future leader, and she attends all board meetings. So she's 25 and it's just part of their becoming a future director, which the IOD put on. We've had no other female directors. We have had in the past. Now we've got our group general manager, Lynn, is now joining the board, but that's because she's had, you know, we've had her for 3 years, great person, great knowledge now about the company. It's worthwhile having on. So I certainly don't like them to say, hey, you need 50% females, or though we have to watch it though, in terms of like the age thing was. We'd probably like to look at, you know, maybe there should be someone Asian on there on the board.
Any other lessons that you can share from your business journey?
I'm just thinking, I wrote a book, Never Hire a Person Who Walks Slowly, which was the ABC of business, and I did an A to Z on. And
do you still believe that one?
Yeah, probably. It's important. People coming to interviews, that when they walk across the car park, our receptionist is primed. And hey, how do they handle her? How do they, if they amble and they're not that interested, we find out. And particularly how they handle the receptionist, you know.
Can be a big indicator.
That's an indicator. Yeah. You know, I mean, I suppose it's how they, if they're sort of slouch slowly, but if they're thinking, maybe they're, yeah, so it's not an absolute. But within that, I've probably, you know, L is for lawyers, ended half my legal friend, but I don't want to know every law since 1908 on something that's, hey, just tell me what it is. Tell me what the is and what's the commercial, best commercial way of this, of doing this. So I'm saying, hey, find yourself a lawyer who just tells you what the issues are, and then say, okay, what are the odds of us doing this, that, the other thing. You have to often watch corporate people, particularly coming into a company, you just have to watch that they're not too corporatized, and you get beautiful reports and they say the right things, but nothing's really happening. That's something that we watch on that, getting a corporate person in.
Right, so the background can make quite a difference in terms of how someone actually operates. You get someone's...
Yeah, I mean, if you're used to working in a corporate, there's, you know, a lot more politics, and so you have to put this glossy bit of paper in front of some glossy report. And you try and say the good things. We want the bad things out, and we want, hey, if you made a mistake, bloody just say it.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
it's so important to know what those things are, so you can address them and do better in future, right?
Yeah.
Rather than you don't want that shiny report that's not the real deal.
So to say, you know, hey, I stuffed up. Hey, so what? But to admit straight away, and I said probably too often.
And so is that part of the way that you've created a culture where people feel comfortable to just say that they've, you know, not done so well at something? The fact that you it sounds like you lead from the front in those regards and are quite open about, you know, if you make a mistake.
Yeah, so we've got nine brands, and they've all got their own websites, and each one there's the CEO's guarantee, which is me, which says, hey, if you think that you have been treated unfairly or whatever, we regard every one of our customers, our staff, our shareholders, as a member of the Just Life Group family, you feel we haven't treated you fairly, please ring me direct. Please contact me directly. And I have my phone number and my mobile phone number and email address on there. And that provides, I suppose, a bit of confidence to people that they can. And, you know, and often get generally a text at a weekend, you know, my water didn't arrive. Normally it's because they haven't paid or something. But they immediately get a message back that says, hey, I'm really sorry to hear that. I'll you know, contact you back on first thing Monday morning and forward it off to customer services and it gets answered Monday morning.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so if people are angry, they can ring me. Now, you'd think, you know, people say, gee, how many calls do you get? And probably three a week. Normally they're actually texts. We get one call a week. So it helps just build credibility for the company.
And it's a great example, isn't it, to your whole team that you absolutely, you know, you care, you're available, obviously to them as you know, as well as to your customers.
Yeah, so we communicate. I mean, communication is the one thing that people always complain about on our, you know, if we're doing surveys. And so we really try and just, we have a Monday message, which is a voice message from one of our leadership team. One of the leadership team goes out to everybody. We do a lot of trying to communicate with them.
So you focus on internal communications and then clients as well? How do you?
Yeah, we do a lot of the real sales ones.
Yeah.
But in terms of clients, we're upgrading our some of the things we do in terms of, you know, we look at, say, Apple, how their product is presented and everything. Yeah, we probably don't really have that much contact with them afterwards, apart from the people who are regular customers, like the supplement customers we're talking to all the time. But, you know, we encourage them to be in contact with us.
Yeah.
And we try and make that experience when they do contact us. Hey, it's Tony. It's Tony speaking. I'm here to look after you.
Excellent. And with that internal communication piece, what does that look like? Because you've got 150 people, you can't talk to everyone personally every day. What are the sorts of things that you do? You talked about, you know, voice communication, putting that out.
We have conferences. We have. Obviously, we go down to Hamilton and Wellington quite often, and it's really just being around. We have end of month meetings. We have we've gone away only during COVID. We no alcohol on premises. Again, we just it's too dangerous as a company to have, you know, something happens to them when they're under health and safety. But instead of that, so we went away from no alcohol to having a feast at the end of the month, a really big Thai or Japanese or something feast. So it's a really upmarket affair, and we have the whole of upstairs is really devoted to the fun part.
Yeah, good. Anything else you wanted to add before we finish, Tony?
No, I think business is fun. I mean, I think it's like a game. And people say to me, hey, when are you going to retire? I say, well, when I don't enjoy the game anymore. It is like a game of Monopoly or of probably more like chess, as you're trying to think ahead what's happening there with the customer or the staff member or whatever, and trying to prevent anything happening that's going to go the wrong way.
Yeah, look, I'm a big proponent of that. Looking ahead, I tend to call it futurist thinking and having that view that goes out beyond the challenges and the stresses and, you know, the issues that you might have to deal with today. So definitely resonates, and yeah, it sounds like it's worked out very, very well for you.
Yeah, no, we're very happy with that.
Yeah, that's great.
Every day is an exciting day.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for your time, Tony.
That's a pleasure, Paul.
All right, cheers.
The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.